Were you aware of some of the activities that Exxon was doing to get equipment to the scene?
To the best of my knowledge, the information that we had from Exxon was only through the RRT and through the press conferences that were held on Saturday by Mr. Iarossi. And in fact, that is how I learned that Exxon was asserting that it had taken over the spill. The indication at the press conference was that as of noon on Saturday, they had initiated that takeover of responsibility and that that was completed by 6 p.m.
Where is the Zone 1 in Prince William Sound?
May I use the map?
Yes, please.
You're listening to testimony from Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, Dennis
Zone
Kelso.
Zone 1 generally extends on either side of the tanker lane in this fashion and then down to Hinchinbrook entrance, basically the bulk of this open water area, and then close up to the Bligh Reef area, there's a boundary, and during most of the year, during the period from October through March, this entire area is also Zone 1.
Kelso is pointing to a chart of Prince William Sound and indicating where the use of dispersants would be allowed under an agreement which had just actually gone into effect. And it shows that in the deep water, where you won't see too many migratory fish at this early time of year, it would be possible, this would be called Zone 1, and an area where dispersants could be used. This is, in effect, where the oil was going, where it was on its way to, as it's gouting out of the Exxon Valdez.
And this was an area where the Department of Environmental Conservation had given oil companies prior approval to use dispersants.
Traffic separation scheme or traffic lanes.
Discuss the movement of the spill, the kind of equipment that was supposed to be moving into the area. It was just a general overview at that point. I think they also discussed the use of dispersants because dispersants had been pre-approved in Zone 1 by the RRT earlier in March. So that was the kind of discussion, and our participation is as a normal full-scale member of the regional response team.
Is that an advisory position, or how is that?
Well, we sit as a full member of the RRT. We are the state's member to that, and the regional response team advises the Coast Guard on-scene coordinator.
Did Lynn Kent, did she concur with what was going on at the RRT meeting?
In what respect?
She sat in on all these discussions, and did she make any recommendations or for equipment or do anything that wasn't being done or was in process of being done?
At that initial meeting, of course, the expectation was that there would be the full response that had been promised in the contingency plan. Later in the day, we talked with Lynn Kent because we were not seeing that happen. So Lynn contacted Captain Haynes after we had put together a letter requesting the RRT to reevaluate whether Alyeska and Exxon would really do what had been promised by the contingency plan. And she contacted Captain Haynes directly in order to ask that the RRT take a hard look at just what response was actually being fielded. Then at that time, we attempted to send by fax a copy of the letter, which could not be successfully transmitted just because of a problem with the receiving end of the fax. So we made sure that the content of that letter was conveyed to Captain Haynes, and then it was communicated by fax first thing in the morning between 8 and 8:30 on Saturday morning.
I'm a little confused. What did that letter say?
The letter indicated that Alyeska had not responded with what was listed in the contingency plan. This really was a this really was a failure of performance under the plan, and we knew that we could not wait for this situation to go further, because our experience with the spill from the Glacier Bay, the tanker Glacier Bay in 1987, in which we worked very closely with the Coast Guard, that experience had shown that we absolutely had to watch exactly what was developing in the way of containment and response, and that we could not wait for the situation to progress beyond the point at which the Coast Guard could take a more directive role. Otherwise, what happened with the Glacier Bay was that for the first 2 days, there was passing of the ball around the circle of potentially liable parties and no cleanup happening. We were determined that that not happen in this instance. We knew clearly who held the responsibility. It was Alyeska. Exxon had come into the picture, of course, but we wanted to make sure that the on-scene coordinator held their feet to the fire, and that if they weren't going to perform, that the decision was made early to intervene rather than to wait until things were out of hand.
Were you aware of some of the activities that Exxon was doing to get equipment to the scene?
To the best of my knowledge, the information that we had from Exxon was only through the RRT and through the press conferences that were held on Saturday by Mr. Iarossi. And in fact, that is how I learned that Exxon was asserting that it had taken over the spill. The indication at the press conference was that as of noon on Saturday, they had initiated that takeover of responsibility, and that that was completed by 6 p.m.
Where is the Zone 1 in Prince William Sound?
May I use the map?
Yes, please.
You're listening to testimony from Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, Dennis
Zone
Kelso.
Zone 1 generally extends on either side of the tanker lane in this fashion, and then down to Hinchinbrook entrance, basically the bulk of this open water area, and then close up to the Bly Reef area, there's a boundary, and during most of the year, during the period from October through March, this entire area is also Zone 1.
Kelso is pointing to a chart of Prince William Sound and indicating where the use of dispersants would be allowed under an agreement which had just actually gone into effect. And it shows that in the deep water, where you won't see too many migratory fish at this early time of year, it would be possible, this would be called Zone 1, and an area where dispersants could be used. This is, in effect, where the oil was going, where it was on its way to, as it's gouting out of the Exxon Valdez.
And this was area where the Department of Environmental Conservation had given the oil companies prior approval to use dispersants.
Traffic separation scheme, or traffic lanes.
That's right, and a large area on either side in basically a diamond pattern.
That Glacier Bay, was that an American vessel or a foreign vessel?
I'm not sure what the registry was. It was owned by Trinidad Shipping.
How big a spill was that?
It's about 300,000 gallons.
Did Alyeska have the equipment at the terminal? It was just not getting it out to the scene? Was that the big problem?
The indications we have are that the equipment was available but not deployed as the plan required.
Okay. Was the scenario for the 200,000 barrel spill in the plan, was that unrealistic in the first place? that, you know, that much oil being spilled at one point and only being handled by dispersants?
I'm sorry, I don't.
My understanding is that basically they were going to use dispersants to take care of the spill.
Well, the 200,000 barrel scenario described a variety of equipment that would be used. In that scenario was discussed the use of dispersants, and in part because the use of dispersants appear to have some utility for this kind of a spill, we made sure that we worked with the RRT to get the pre-approval so that there would be no need to return to us to get approval in that Zone 1 area. But it was very clear, I think, from the 200,000 barrel scenario in the plan that mechanical recovery was to be relied on, and the Coast Guard, of course, had made clear in this instance that mechanical recovery was the preferred method because the conditions were perfect for that. They were not ideal, however, for dispersants. The weather corresponded almost perfectly to the assumptions in the 200,000 barrel scenario. Virtually no seas, wind conditions very low, not much current in that particular area. It was ideal for implementing the 200,000 barrels scenario response.
With the equipment they had, if they would have gotten it out to the scene and used their mechanical pickup devices, would those devices and the equipment they could store it in when they picked it up, would that have been sufficient equipment?
According to what the plan represented, there would have been the capacity, if those assumptions held, and they did, to recover 240,000 barrels with the equipment that the contingency plan had designated.
How long would that take with the equipment they have?
That would have been completed prior to the first 72 hours, according to the specifications they provided.
That's all the questions I have.
Captain Deppe.
Now the representative from Exxon will question Commissioner of Environmental
Mr.
Conservation,
Kelso, did,
Dennis Kelso.
Your department ever give notice to Exxon that a determination had been made that the cleanup activities conducted by Exxon were inadequate?
Absolutely. I met with Mr. Irasi. We met with the Exxon staff and with the Coast Guard, and of course we met also with the RRT and conveyed our views in that way. I personally let Mr. Irasi know that we considered the response to be inadequate. In fact, during the first days of the spill, it was so inadequate that local people were coming to us saying, "Why is nothing happening?" And we would then talk to Exxon and say, "What is the problem?" We would get from Exxon a list of equipment or a list of people that were being mobilized, and we had no doubt that there was an effort being made to mobilize, but what we weren't seeing was response in the field that was actually picking up oil, and that was what the great concern was. That's what we needed to see results in.
Mr. Kelso and Captain Deppe, if you can keep your questions and your responses to within the 24 hours. Mr. Kelso, can you tell me when you had that meeting with Mr. Irasi?
Well, the meeting...
Was it within 24 hours?
No. Mr. Irasi arrived after the governor and I had gone to the tanker on Friday evening. There was a press conference...
Mr. Kelso, the answer was no, it's not within the 24 hours.
No,
thank you. Mr. Kelso, did your department ever hire anyone to begin cleanup activities within the first 24 hours?
Within the first 24 hours, it was our expectation that we would be doing our normal monitoring, quality control, damage assessment work, and that the responsible party, Alyeska and Exxon, would be carrying out the cleanup.
Does that mean no?
We had mobilized a response team, which included bringing on board an oil spill contractor, but that was to, at that point, we expected it to be to advise us. So, yes, we began to bring a team together, but it was not with the expectation that we were going to have to do the cleanup. That realization came later.
Do you feel that funding cuts to your department might have hurt your response to this spill?
This was a spill that needed an immediate response. It was not a spill that could, it was not a response that would have been different had there been additional inspections. We were well aware of the equipment that was available. We were well aware of the plan that Alyeska had committed to, and we see this as a failure of performance. It would not have been changed by having more staff in Valdez. It might have provided additional opportunities to work with other problems that Alyeska has in air and water pollution, but it would not have made a difference in the way they responded here.
So what's the answer? No? Is the answer no?
You ask me a question that requires more than a yes or no. You ask me whether the lack of funding hurt our ability to respond. And I'm saying that if you're asking me whether additional inspection would have made a difference here, I'm saying no, it would not have made a difference.
The answer is no, thank you.
Well, was that the question?
Yes.
I'm not prepared to accept a characterization if that's not what you were asking me.
Oh, that's exactly what I asked. In spill drills that your department witnessed and observed, were you satisfied with Alyeska's performance prior to this spill?
Alyeska's performance was spotty. In 1984, they performed inadequately. We called them on it. They said, well, if this had been a real spill, of course we would have done things better. That was a red flag to us. The spill drills are an important part of preparedness. So we required additional spill drills in 85 and 86. And when this plan was revised, we required as a condition of approval that a successful completion of a spill drill be accomplished, and that was accomplished in November of 1986.
Okay, what was the size of that spill drill that you witnessed in 86?
I would have to look at my notes on that. It was a smaller spill, and I don't remember exactly where it was located, but it was intended as a test of full response. We have two kinds, basically. One is desktop, and the other is full mobilization, and this was intended to be mobilization.
Mr. Kelso, what's a compliance order?
In what context?
In regard to an oil spill contingency plan?
Well, normally a compliance order, I'm not sure what you're asking, but normally a compliance order is an order that we enter into, that we make for a company who is in violation of a regulation or a permit requirement, to bring them back into compliance, and those can be of a variety of kinds, but the basic approach is to establish an order that would be enforceable in court if the company fails to conform to its requirements.
Yeah. In connection with Alyeska's plan, did you issue any compliance orders?
I have since issued an emergency order.
Were these done prior to the spill?
No. What we have done with Alyeska is to issue some very specific requirements for strengthening the plan. And if you look back that process really extends back to 1977.
Captain William Deppe from Exxon.
But there were no compliance orders prior to the spill, as far as you know.
Well,
As far as Alyeska's contingency plan is concerned.
Had there been a violation of the plan, that would have been an appropriate circumstance to issue a compliance order. Here, the problem was the plan was intact, but the performance was wholly inadequate.
Mr. Kelso, in your opinion,
Captain,
do you think...
Captain Deppe?
Yeah.
One minute, please.
Okay.
Chairman Lee Dickinson has interrupted the questioning. Captain William Deppe has been questioning Commissioner of Environmental Conservation Dennis Kelso.
The amount of oil that was spilled, do you think that there was any power on earth that could have mechanically contained the spill and cleaned it up?
I think that had the powers that were present, Alyeska and Exxon, done what they had promised in this plan, it would be a very different situation today. The commitment that Alyeska made was to have the capacity to pick up 240,000 barrels with a certain set of assumptions. Of course, they did not do that. It was grossly under that level. And it is only in hindsight, of course, that we can see that neither Exxon nor Alyeska was prepared to do what they had committed to do. But I think had the resources been properly mobilized, this would have been a very different situation. If I had had the monetary resources that Exxon had, the expertise that my staff had, the creativity and energy that local people brought to this task, and the support that the Coast Guard provides so well, this would have been a very different situation had we been running it.
Did your people ensure that the equipment that was available would be able to pick up the oil, 240,000 barrels of oil, in the time allotted in the plan?
The way that oil spill contingency plans are done in Alaska and virtually everywhere else in the country is that it is industry that comes forth with the plan, that makes the commitment to do the job, and that then implements the plan. It may well be that we should do as you suggest, which is to make the change so that the state or the Coast Guard is in a position to require certain things in the contingency plan and then to do the implementation steps rather than waiting for industry to prove that it can't do the job and then have to step in.
You said earlier that the Coast Guard made the determination that the spill should be mechanically contained and cleaned up. In what way did they do that, and who did that with the Coast Guard?
I think what I said was that the Coast Guard had indicated in discussions with the RRT that mechanical cleanup was the preferred method. The Coast Guard did not rule out the use of chemical dispersants. In fact, from the beginning, that was discussed, and I believe that the on-scene coordinator approved the request for trial application that Alyeska made on the first day. Of course, Alyeska did not have the equipment appropriate to deliver the dispersants on the scale that has since been suggested by Exxon that they would have liked, but the on-scene coordinator did not rule out the use of those dispersants at all. The conditions were such, though, that favored mechanical cleanup. It was ideal for booming and skimming. There would have been a real opportunity to pick up a good share of that leading edge of the spill using containment boom. And so I think that the on-scene coordinator was getting at that. He was not suggesting that you couldn't use other means, but there was not sufficient energy in the sea state to really provide the agitation necessary for an effective dispersant use.
You said there was a good chance to pick up a good percentage of the leading edge of the spill with mechanical means. What do you mean by a good percentage of the leading edge of the spill? How much oil are you talking about?
Well, what I'm suggesting is that in the contingency plan, the commitment was made to contain a spill and clean up a spill that was of a magnitude that this spill was. And so when the state or the Coast Guard looked at the implementation of the plan, what we expected is that they would deliver what they promised in the plan, which was a full response. It should have been well contained. It should have been hit very hard while it was still in this thick pancake, and that simply didn't happen. So they should have been able to do very well, and they should have been able to live up to what the plan contemplated, what it said.
So you think that 100% of the oil could have been cleaned up if all aspects of the plan were followed?
Well, I'm saying that is industry's responsibility to deliver on. It's Alyeska that made the assurance that they'd be able to handle that level of spill. That's what they listed in their equipment list. And they had provided early assurances of being able to pick up, for example, in a letter a few years before this plan was approved, they had assured that they'd be able to pick up 100,000 barrels in 48 hours. It is not the state's or the Coast Guard's responsibility to second-guess industry when it is industry's legal obligation to deliver on what their contingency plan says they can accomplish.
Mr. Kelso, are you saying then that they should have picked up 100% of the spill? I think that was the question that was asked.
I'm saying that at this point no one knows what amount of that oil could have been picked up, but it was Alyeska's plan. It was not our telling them what equipment they needed to get that job done. They're the ones who committed to doing it, and under their plan and the assumptions of that plan, they should have been able to pick up a good chunk of that spill. And by that I mean their numbers, their nameplate numbers said 240,000 barrels. Whether they came short of that in the actual circumstances, no one can say, even in hindsight, but it should still have been a very substantial recovery.
Mr. Kelso, if your department had pre-approval to use dispersants, why did the Coast Guard state that Exxon only had authority to test and would need state and federal approval before allowing general use of dispersants?
Captain Deputy, is that a question that the state can ask, or is that a question that the Coast Guard should answer?
Well, if he can answer it, I'd like him to answer it.
Can you answer that question, yes or no? Do you know that?
I don't have information on that.
Thank you, Mr. Kelson. Okay.
That's all. Thanks.
Mr. Howitt, almost called you Mr. Shire, excuse me.
William Howitt is the representative from Alyeska Pipeline Service Corporation. He's going to be asking questions of Dennis Kelso.
Ask Mr. Kelso about some questions about Exhibit 10H, which is the State of Alaska approval process for the oil spill contingency plan.
Mr. Kelso, do you have 10 Hotel?
Yes, I do.
Mr. Kelso, do you have that exhibit in front of you?
I do.
Okay. Have you reviewed that exhibit?
Yes, I have.
Would you characterize that chronology of events to be a fair and complete description of the contingency plan process from 1977 through 1989?
The material that I've seen here, although obviously is just an outline, this does not contain the detail that the backup documents contain. I think it's an accurate representation as I know it.
Well, then, is it true that the state approved the Alyeska contingency plan for Prince William Sound in 1987?
It was conceptually approved with conditions by letter in 1986, and one of the conditions was successful completion of a spill drill. There were some other conditions as well, and then there was a subsequent approval in March with a couple of other conditions to be completed by Alyeska.
And do you know when the final approval was given to Alyeska?
I think that the March letter served as that approval, and Alyeska then carried out the other steps that were required.
Were you commissioner of the DEC at that time?
I was not commissioner of DEC when the conceptual approval was given and when the spill drill was completed. I was commissioner when the final approval was provided.
Did you approve or did you review and approve the contingency plan prior to its final approval?
Did I personally review it? I believe that I personally reviewed the letter that was sent because this was a matter that had been so difficult to achieve, getting what we viewed as an adequate plan developed with Alyeska, but I did not do the plan review. That would not normally be my function.
Can you tell me why the approval of the 1987 plan was omitted from the chronology?
Well, the chronology, I don't know whether it was omitted as a matter of intention, but the...
Can you tell me why the approval of the 1987 plan was omitted from the chronology?
Well, the chronology, I don't know whether it was omitted as a matter of intention, but the dates of the letters that we're talking about are, I think, April 23rd, 1986, during March, I'd have forgotten the date now, of 1987.
Are you aware that the state of Alaska, as well as the federal government, approved Alyeska's contingency plans beginning in 1987, beginning in 1977?
I'm aware that contingency plans were required by state law and that those plans were approved in accordance with statute.
Well, are you specifically aware that the Alaska Department of Natural Resources as well as the BLM have approved the Alyeska contingency plan every year from 1977 through 1988?
Are you talking about their responsibility under the state right-of-way lease?
Yes.
I'm aware of the right-of-way lease. There are three sources of authority for the state to require the contingency plans. One is state statute having to do with oil spill prevention and response. One is the state right-of-way lease, and the other is permit conditions.
Mr. Kelso, your chronology references a May 1, 1984 report, which was actually an internal ADEC memorandum discussing Alyeska's preparedness for an oil spill. Is it common practice for the ADEC to rely on internal memorandums to criticize or provide critiques and not transmit those to Alyeska?
All of our files are open to the public, and when we interact with a regulated entity such as Alyeska, we normally deal directly with the regulated party. In this instance, of course, and I don't have specific information about the May 1984 item, but I do know that communications with Alyeska are very difficult because and I'm not talking about the lower level staff that we work with all the time, but at the upper levels, there is a real reluctance to meet the spirit of these environmental requirements, period.
So, is it because of upper management that you decided not to transmit your critiques to Alyeska?
I do not accept your suggestion that we did not transmit the critiques. I think we have been straightforward with Alyeska about what things they need to improve, and I assume that you would not be surprised that we have internal communications that serve a function within the agency in evaluating what steps we ought to take and what steps we don't need to take.
Well, then, are you saying that the DEC did transmit their critiques directly to Alyeska?
I'm saying that our normal procedure would be to have some kind of discussion with Alyeska if we were asking them to make changes. If we were in an exchange of letters with them, we would...
positive information that I asked that not have answers. The last Oracle exercise that you mentioned in the finale, I believe, was October 17, 1984. Are you suggesting that that was the last drill that was performed or observed by the DEC?
Oh, no. There were oil spill drills in 1985, 1986, 87, and 88, I believe. Certainly up through 87, and then in 88 and 89, we, of course, had direct observation of spill response. We find direct observation to be more useful than spill drills. Spill drills are useful, but they are a substitute for the real thing, and when you have the real thing happen, that gives us a much better picture of how the company is going to react and mobilize equipment.
Mr. Kelso, in May of 1988, ADEC participated with ARCO and Alyeska in a major desktop drill, and then later on an equipment mobilization. One of the purposes of that drill was to involve ADEC in the phase transition process for a spiller to take over a spill from Alyeska. Was the ADEC satisfied with that response, and did that make you aware of what our plans would be?
I'm aware of the exercise and the fact that we observed it. I don't have specific information on how that conveyed information about the way Alyeska saw its relationship to the owner companies. I do know that the Alyeska contingency plan specifically says that Alyeska will serve as the agent of the owner companies in spill responses for Prince William Sound.
One of the exercises in that drill was to exercise the decision about applying dispersants. Are you aware that the DEC did not approve dispersants at that time, and that was one of the objectives of the exercise, was to work that problem?
Dispersant use was pre-approved for Zone 1 in Prince William Sound at a meeting on March 7th and 8th of this year, roughly 3 weeks before this spill occurred.
Your chronology says that ADEC reached an agreement on the use of dispersants in 1986. Was this agreement published?
The 1986 discussion of dispersants, I think, involved the regional response team and laid the groundwork for the approval, the pre-approval of dispersant use within Prince William Sound. I think everyone realized that if there were a spill for which dispersant use was appropriate, it was important to have in place the pre-approval so we wouldn't lose time at the instant when a spill occurred and we might need to be able to use it. At the same time, everyone recognized that dispersant use should not be uncontrolled because it poses a different kind of risk to biological organisms. So what we did along with the RRT was approve dispersant use in those areas where it could be safely used, and to make sure that that was already done so that the Coast Guard on-scene coordinator had the discretion to authorize it whenever he saw fit. That was the work that was done in 86. Then I think Alyeska knew that that would be extended to Prince William Sound. There were discussions of it prior to the meeting on March 7th and 8th, and then it was formalized on March 7th and 8th.
Mr. Kelso, you've testified before, since the spill, that ADEC is a hard-nosed agency. Would you agree that that's correct?
I think we're both firm and fair, and I think Alaskans expect that.
In your chronology, you cite that you dedicated considerable staff time and a lengthy, deliberate process of review in order to establish with Alyeska the 1987 contingency plan. In reference to that, would you consider that process a model program?
I think that the process produced a sound plan, and we made a commitment to do that because we wanted to make sure that we built on what we had learned from Alyeska's operation and from the tanker trade in Prince William Sound.
Mr. Kelso, who's Paul O'Brien?
Paul O'Brien was previously the manager of our oil spill program.
Was Mr. O'Brien responsible as the ADEC official for reviewing and recommending approval of the 1987 plan?
Mr. O'Brien would have had the lead in that, and he would have worked with our field staff in doing the review, but it would have come back to him for basically a final recommendation.
Paul O'Brien was recently quoted in the Anchorage Daily News as saying that nowhere in the world are there enough resources in one place to deal with a spill of up to 200,000 barrels. Do you agree with that?
One of the things we learned from this was that the world's inventory of equipment was not readily available to respond. The contingency plan contemplates backup from a variety of sources, bringing in equipment from different locations, mobilizing everything from dispersants to boom from different organizations around the country and around the world. And I think that Mr. O'Brien points out one of the basic policy needs that comes out of this whole episode, and that is that it is important not only that there be state-of-the-art equipment available to respond, but also that there be a worldwide inventory on computers so that that equipment and material can be mobilized in a timely way. In this instance, it seems to me that having provided its assurance that Alyeska was ready to respond to a spill of this magnitude under these conditions, that Alyeska should be held to that promise.
You've stated that the ADEC had pre-approved dispersant application in Zone 1. In your opinion, was the OSC wrong to have required testing before that dispersant was applied in Zone 1, or should that have been done without testing?
The OSC had no need to come back to us for approval, and I think I would not characterize what Commander McCall required as testing. I viewed it as trial application. He simply wanted to see if this would work, given that the conditions were not favorable for dispersant application.
Well, given your pre-approval in Zone 1, do you think testing was warranted in this case?
I think he simply wanted to see if it would work, rather than have resources expended in that kind of response if it was going to be ineffective.
I'd like to ask a few questions with respect to another exhibit. That would be 10 Charlie. The particular area I'd like to address is the 4,000 barrel scenario, which is on the Alyeska numbered page 3-50. It's about 5 or 10 pages from the back. Do you have that, Mr. Kelso?
I do have it in front of me.
Are you familiar with the scenario and the approved contingency plan for 400,000 barrels?
I have read this scenario.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
I read the scenario.
Would you consider the 4,000 barrel scenario as defined by the state a minor, a moderate, or a large spill?
I think that's a large spill.
Have you noted in this scenario that although dispersant decision is presumed to have been made and the application was feasible, that approximately one-third of the total spilled hit the beaches and resulted in a two-month cleanup?
I'm not sure I understand why this is relevant to what we're discussing here.
Well, the reason I feel it's relevant is it's part of the plan.
This is one of the scenarios. This is not the scenario that was relevant to this particular thing. I'm happy to answer your questions, but it seems to me rather far afield.
Well, my question was, are you aware that even though dispersant was applied in this particular scenario, that one-third of it hit the beaches and required, in our estimation, an approximately two-month cleanup.
I know what's in the written scenario. I think the, maybe I'm missing your point.
Mr. Kelso, I think Mr. Howitt may have missed a point, too, because aren't you talking beyond our agreed-to limits of 24 hours in your discussion of dispersants?
Well, I was referencing the contingency plan itself, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't talking particularly about response by Alyeska beyond 24 hours.
Alyeska is William Howitt, questioning Commissioner Dennis Kelso.
Okay, thank you.
Well, then can I return to your question? You're suggesting, I guess I don't understand what you're suggesting. Are you suggesting that even with the use of dispersants, you have a cleanup problem?
Yes, that's what I'm suggesting.
I think even with the use of dispersants, the use of effective use of mechanical means is necessary. You might also note that in the 200,000 barrel scenario, the trajectory there indicated contact with areas such as Naked Island, Eleanor Island, Main Bay, and that as a result of the trajectory that Alyeska had supplied, we asked for changes to the exclusion areas. Those exclusion areas would be things like Main Bay, which are particularly sensitive. And of course, not only was that included in this contingency plan specifically, but it was also not done when the spill occurred.
Well, my point, Mr. Kelso, involved the...
How about your question, Mr.?
What's that?
Your question and not your point.
All right. My question, Mr. Kelso, was that the assumption in the 400 or the 4,000 barrel scenario involved approximately one-third of the oil going on the beach. Would you not agree that the 4,000 barrel scenario is considerably different from the catastrophic event in a 200,000 barrel scenario?
The 4,000 barrel scenario is not only different in volume, the conditions that are assumed here are also substantially different. So the two are not comparable in that respect. What I have said about the use of tools, such as dispersants and mechanical, is you use whatever tools are appropriate for the conditions. The conditions here favored mechanical recovery. We had pre-approved the use of dispersant, and had this plan been carried out as it had been indicated, there should have been a substantial recovery of oil and containment of oil, and that did not happen.
Mr. Kelso, I'd like to talk about the 200,000 barrel scenario. And I believe that's on page 3-54 and 3-55. When you approved the 1987 contingency plan, did you read the environmental considerations section of the 200,000 barrel scenario?
Our staff worked on all of the aspects of the plan, to the best of my knowledge.
You've stated that you expected Alyeska to make a substantial physical recovery, especially within the first 24 hours. On page 3-55, the recovery rates for the Alyeska skimmers are listed. Do you see those?
Yes.
Could you read what the recovery rates are for me for the Marco Class 5, Class 7, and the Vicoma Sea Skimmer?
The under the table, the listed recovery rates in barrels per hour are 428 for the Marco Class 5, 428 for the Marco Class 7, and the two Vicoma CPACs are not listed with a recovery rate. However, bear in mind that each of these pieces of equipment comes with a rating of its own, and if you look at basically the nameplate ratings for those, you come out with some very specific levels of recovery that are being included by Alyeska in the equipment that they're saying that they will have in place.
I'm referencing the contingency plan itself here, Mr. Kelso, and I believe you'll also note that the sea skimmer, which, pardon me, is not listed as a Vicoma sea skimmer, it's listed as the sea skimmer. It's listed at 536 barrels per hour. You see that? Given these rates, what would you expect in the first 24 hours if optimal conditions were available?
Given the fact that the conditions, the assumptions in the plan were met virtually to a T, winds less than 15 knots, sea state less than 5 feet, currents less than 1.6 knots, waves less than 2 feet, visibility equal to or greater than 2 miles, we would have expected optimum recovery. What the exact hourly recovery would be in terms of barrels, I don't know, except for what each of these pieces of equipment is rated at. I do know that we don't even get to that point in the inquiry because this equipment wasn't deployed. We waited for this equipment on site. We were assured that it was en route, and it never showed up. When I was on the tanker at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, there were two smaller pieces of equipment working. There was a barge present, but none of the other equipment had been put in place that we could see, and the teams that had been promised as part of the general plan, as far as we know, were never deployed.
Do you know this from personal knowledge that this equipment wasn't deployed, or are you basing this from your view on the ship?
I viewed the operation from the air on the way in. I viewed it from the vessel. I viewed it the following day, and I interviewed staff about what equipment was on scene. I don't know what Alyeska may have done internally, but I do know what I saw in the field.
Mr. Kelso, could you view the leading edge of the spill from the vessel?
From the vessel, I would not have been able to discern the leading edge. From the air, I certainly could.
So are you positive that these three pieces of equipment were not working at the leading edge of the spill?
It appeared to me from my observation that they were working in the spill, in the slick, but not at the leading edge. In fact, they did not appear to be operating in any particular systematic fashion. When I observed them, they didn't appear to be heading in the same direction. There were short lengths of boom deployed from the mouth of the skimmers, but there didn't appear to be anything really guiding the skimmers. I saw no indication that they
Kelso,
were being directed.
I would ask you to respond to the question, and not the safety board is not here to analyze any of the contingency plans. I would request that you answer the question and in your best opinion give your answer. Thank you.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear if he answered the question or not.
What was your question?
My question was, were you able to observe the leading edge of the spill and to know whether those pieces of equipment were in fact working on the spill or not?
I observed the leading edge of the spill from the air. I, from my observation, believe that the equipment was not working the leading edge, but was located in the slick.
So are you saying that that equipment was working?
The equipment was not at the leading edge.
I think you said that the equipment was working, yes.
You're listening to live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board hearing, live from the Captain Cook Hotel in downtown Anchorage. This comes to you from KSK Anchorage and APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
George Nelson in the Civic Center, and I believe that was in the first 24 hours. But I'm not certain that was within the 24 hours.
Okay, thank you. I have no other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Howitt. Commander Waldron?
No questions.
Dr. LaResh?
Commissioner Kelso, simply stated, do you see the problem that in the response here as due to deficiencies in the contingency plan?
No, I think the problem was execution of the plan.
Do you think it was due to deficiencies in the state approval process of this contingency plan?
No, the state worked very hard to build new safeguards into this plan. They were ultimately incorporated, and we had every reason to expect that it would be carried out, especially since we'd observed spills in January and March.
We've all learned a lot, I think, especially you, in the past 8 weeks. In light of what you have learned since this accident, would adjustments in the contingency plan be sufficient correction for the mistakes made?
There's nothing that changing the contingency plan could do to ensure that there was actual performance, and that's what the problem was.
Are you satisfied with the state's 24-hour response?
The state's 24-hour response, I think, was aggressive and professional.
Mr. Iarossi testified earlier that it was Exxon's contingency plan, which Exxon Shipping Company implemented. Is that consistent with state regulations?
There is only one state-approved contingency plan for oil spill response, and that is Alyeskas.
Thank you, Commissioner. No more questions, Mr. Chairman.
Bob LaResh, asking questions for the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Kelso. Appreciate your testimony. You're excused from a witness stand. It's been a nice 12-hour day. I thank you. We will... I heard 7:30. No, we just went beyond 7:30. I'm sorry, Commander. We will... recess until tomorrow morning at 0800 again. Keep in mind, we have three witnesses tomorrow, and we have to be out of this room by noon. So we will start again at 8 a.m., 0800 here. Thank you.
So it's been an interesting evening here. We had, I guess what you'd have to characterize as a couple of sparring matches there between Dennis Kelso and the people who are speaking for Alyeska and Exxon, each of whom wanted to try and pin Kelso down and get him away from his broad characterizations of how inadequate the response to the spill was on the part of both those companies. Of course, I'd say they did their job fairly well, because the fact of the matter is that the state did approve the contingency plan. The contingency plan does have dispersants in it. But at the same time, because of this rule that they have as to what is to be discussed, they couldn't talk about anything after 24 hours past the spill. So this kind of limited the discussion.
And in fact, we heard this sparring back and forth, and at various times, Chairman Lee Dickinson pretty much just stepped in, put his foot down, and said, "Okay, guys, cut it out, quit your squabbling." Because each side was trying to make its points. Kelso is on the stand and can answer questions the way he wants and direct things the way he wants, and Alyeska and Exxon have points that they're trying to bring out. They'll get their response tomorrow. William Howitt, who was asking questions today, is going to be on the stand tomorrow, as are some other representatives from, Lawrence Shire from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company. Oh, and William Howitt are both scheduled to testify tomorrow, so Alyeska will get its chance to get some of its points across about some of the issues that have been raised here. In many respects, parts of Kelso's testimony were a repeat of the congressional hearings that were held in Valdez two weekends ago. His insistence that the response was slow, if non-existent at times, that was the way he characterized it. Gone was some of the powerful rhetoric that he used at the hearings, but the points he was trying to make were virtually the same, and in some respects, this is a real repeat of that.
Yes. His essential point is that there was hardly any response, regardless of what the plan said, and That's what he just kept saying, and they kept trying to pin him down on, well, didn't you know that we'd be using dispersants, and didn't you approve, and wasn't this a long process, and so forth. But when it came right down to it, there was hardly any response. And that's what he told them, and that's what will stick. Much of this academic to the National Transportation Safety Board, which is trying to find ways to ensure that this won't ever happen again. And that's what earlier testimony focused on. Discussion with Frank Flintz, the Assistant Chief of the Merchant Vessel Personnel Division of the Coast Guard, centered on the deregulation process, how gradually the things that are required of tankers have decreased. There's less crew required, more automation on board, and less requirement for pilotage. A lot of discussion of human factors, rotating leaves, and how well people are able to communicate with one another on tankers. These are more the nuts and bolts of the kind of things that the National Transportation Safety Board generally deals with. Frank Iorossi, the president of Exxon Shipping, came in and discussed Exxon's policies, their manning policies, their leave policies, and most of all, their policies with regard to substance use, substance dependency on the part of their employees. We had a man, Joe Hazelwood, who he said is the first case that he'd had to deal with personally on the, of a man who was a captain of a ship who went through drug dependency treatment, and it was a difficult one for them to treat. That's in rather sharp contrast to what Mr. Iorossi had said shortly after the incident, when he said he knew very little about Mr. Hazelwood's drinking background, and that was the man's own business. He's kind of changed his tune on that.
Iorossi also tried to do some of the same things that Kelso was trying to do tonight. He presented a detailed chronology of how